army doesn't like more than one disaster in a day.
Looks bad in the newspapers and upset civilians at their breakfast.
I'm Bill Buebert, retired Army officer and a regular warfare practitioner and scholar. Welcome to Chasing Ghosts, an Irregular Warfare podcast, the show that examines the mythos, lost history, bad thinking, martial malpractice, and government incompetence that informs so much of irregular warfare. Today, I want to peek behind the curtain at the vast machinery and briar patch politics of insurgency and counterinsurgency and everything in between. Now, let's go ghost hunting together. Hello, this is Bill, and welcome to episode 75 of the Chasing Ghosts and Irregular Warfare podcast. This episode's title is Modern Antifa, Communist Insurgency in the U.S. Part 4. There will be a slight departure from the usual martial interest of this podcast so that we can dip a bit into some deep history that I think is essential to understanding where we're at today. But before we do that, I'd like to do a little bit of housekeeping. Books are a big part of my life. I do have a massive library, real and electronic. I do spend a considerable amount of time reading real books, my Kindle, listening to podcasts, listening to books on Audible and other things like that. And because of that, I have a brain that is steeped and not necessarily connected to the spoken word, where if it is an audible book that I've read it, sometimes I will mispronounce words. Two correspondents brought it to my attention recently that I did not employ the word imbroglio properly, and I said imbroglio, so I want to stand corrected on that. Number two, Michael Belisle's is actually pronounced Michael Belial. So I want to stand corrected on both of those because I don't want to look like a dunce, because I do pride myself on specificity of language and employing this beautiful and elegant English language that we are endowed with in the West in the most gracious fashion that I can. So I stand corrected on that. I have been a bit negligent in my research and study for episodes because we've been busy, because life gets in the way. A recent announcement is that I have yet another grandchild on the way. Very happy about that. Youngest son moved closer to me. I will be moving considerably closer to him once we, as I mentioned in the previous podcast, move the bunker complex from where we are here on the Gulf of American coast in Florida to a more northern Gulf of America coast location. So that's going to take up more of my time. So in today's episode, it's going to be a little bit of a departure, and some of my correspondents have said that this entire series on Antifa and communist insurgency in the U.S. is a bit of a departure in the first place. I don't think it is, because for this particular podcast, Irregular Warfare, as an umbrella rubric term for all those things that happen on the left, right, up, and down edges of conventional warfare, are certainly food for thought and things that I want to continue to entertain here. But as those of you who are persistent and perennial listeners know, I'm always concerned about root causes and proximate causes and where did this come from? And I use that tired old saw of, if you don't know where you've been, you can't possibly know where you are. So I come up with this, to some, astonishing to their ears, prognosis that Antifa, the anti-fascist movement in the United States, as presently formed, is a communist insurgency. And I stand by that prognostication. And in the previous three episodes, I went back to the 1920s, 30s, 40s, and 50s in America to show you where the embryonic forms of this government supremacist fascination with facets of the American population and their concomitant activism comes from. Where did it come from and where is it going? Then I spent some time traveling, as it were, as historiography would have us do, talking about radicalism, government supremacist radicalism, and how that has occurred after World War II. It started to instantiate itself through the 60s, the Days of Rage in the 1970s, some activities in the 1980s, the fall of the wall all of a sudden cuts off the organized and very sophisticated communist international activities, espionage, active measures, desinformatia, maskarovka, and all the rest of the gifts to humanity that Soviet communism granted to planet Earth during the 20th century. All of a sudden, from 1989 to 1991, this major, rather well-funded Soviet sponsorship of the communist rubric planet-wide dissolves. Now, just because it dissolves doesn't mean there aren't other communist sponsors planet-wide who have not sort of taken up the cudgel of advancing communism. You can see it with Chavez and Maduro in Venezuela. You can see it with Castro fighting well above their weight and punching well above their weight when it comes to communist influence in Latin America. You can see it with the Chinese. You can see it with the North Koreans. And by the way, you can see it in the Western Academy. I'm not going to concern myself with the European ramparts of that Western Academy. I'm going to concern myself with the United States. I'm going to concern myself with what is this orchid house? What is this viral conditioning? What is this notion that sort of instantiates itself at the retail and wholesale level, starting with our children into young adulthood, and then, of course, sticking with them throughout their adulthood and their working lives, for a portion of the population who find themselves dedicated to said Stalinist vision, said vision of Maduro and Chavez, of Castro, of the communist Chinese, of the North Koreans, and all the rest of the non-state actors that are out there that are pressing and pushing for this communist project. I'm not going to bore you in this episode because I'm hoping that you have listened to the previous three episodes before you start. This isn't necessarily a preamble one needs to fully understand and grok what we're going to discuss during this episode, but I do think it's important to tease at that thread because not only are there linear components to examining the historiography and the impact of this on modern society in the latter part of the 20th century and here in this first quarter of the 21st century in this new millennium, but it's critical to understanding how these political creatures and architectures work and what they seek to do. Now, if there are folks out there who are articulating some of my ideas while not directly related to what I'm going to go in today concerning the military or martial or warfare aspects of this, but those who have treated the more sectarian and maybe institutional aspects of this. So Dad Saves America is John P.'s great podcast. If you haven't listened to it, I highly recommend it. It's called Poisoning of the American Mind, Parts 1 through 4. And he just does a fantastic job of examining what's happening in K through PhD, what is happening in kindergarten through postgraduate programs, and doctors of philosophy that are being minted throughout this conveyor belt of institutionalized mediocrity known as American education. Now, I've spoken in the past at one end of the spectrum where I happen to think that the federal subsidy, if not the government subsidy at the state level and down to the county and city level for government education, is a tremendous mistake. I think that there should be zero subsidy to that. I have a lot of reasons for that, among which is that these schools from K through 12, and we will handle from the freshman level in the collegiate enterprise to through postgraduate, they have seemed to have a singular aspect and mission statement that they've been participating in since the 19th century. And what that means is that schools were designed in America by Horace Mann and Bernard Sears and Harper of the University of Chicago and Thorndike of Columbia Teachers College and some other men to be instruments of the scientific management of a mass population. Schools are intended to produce, through the application of formulaic human beings whose behavior can be predicted and controlled. These are the words of John Taylor Gatto, one of my favorite contemporary, rest in peace, John, critiquers of the modern education system who dug around and tried to find out just where do they come from? What is it about this system that makes the system so bad for a return and I put this in air quotes, investment of so much money, trillions of dollars, where we've seen since 1979 that the Department of Education, ever since its instantiation, has delivered scores that put American students on a competitive disadvantage to the rest of the world. And when you examine this and start to tease out some of the exactitudes that inform why this is the case, this has been the Department of Education, the provisioning of government education, the public schools, which we will refer to as government schools here so that we can be more exacting in our language. They're not to teach people to learn, but for people in there to be taught and indoctrinated. I'm convinced of this for both the non-science, technology, engineering, and mathematics fields, and now, unfortunately, some of the STEM fields. As an engineer myself, I see the evidence every day, every week, every month with my new engineers arriving into our firms who have no grasp of not only the nuts and bolts of scientific empiricism and methodology, but even the more mundane and even banal things that are needed as a baseline of adequate and effective human behavior to achieve complex tasks. Showing up on time, working together in a team, having the comity and gentlemanly comportment to get along with others, how to have disagreements in a gentlemanly fashion, how to have disagreements in the first place, how to reduce one's emotional input into what you do, being able to critically think. Remember what I say about critical thinking. Critical thinking is thinking about thinking to improve your thinking through better thinking. Fortunately, all five of my children were home educated. All of my grandchildren are going to be home educated. My wife taking on the lion's share of that, at times tedious, but at all times the most important task, because no one knows your children better than you, and certainly not the dispassionate and tend to be left of center indoctrination drones that are part of the government teachers unions in K through 12. 3 million teachers in nearly or maybe over 100,000 kindergarten through grade 12 schools and everything in between. Administrators, janitors, and all the folks who are necessary to keep these proto-prison complexes in line, they number 8 million. The teachers' union tends to be very doctrinaire, very left of center, and more than 98% of all the political action committee activities of the government school teachers' unions, one of the largest public sector unions in the U.S., if not the larger, they tend to give to the DNC, the Democrats, who have historically been the greatest champions of not only the provision of government education, but the provision of government everything. Whether one agrees with that or not, that is up to you. As you know, I'm a member of neither party, and a pox on both houses in my mind. So you ask yourself, well, why is he objecting to the government provisioning and subsidy of education? Isn't that something that borders on a right? Well, of course, it can't be a right, because nothing is a right that imposes an obligation on others to take away from their time and resources and have it poached by a government facilitator, whether through funding or time, to do something. So it certainly isn't a right. But we're going to do a short thought experiment here, and that is this. It's the 1930s, it's the Great Depression, and things aren't going well in America. So the provisioning of food is deemed so important by the U.S. government that the U.S. government takes the determination that the government will provision food from farm to table and everything in between. Fast forward to today, and then there are voices in the wilderness like myself, maybe members of my audience, maybe members of a skeptical part of the population who sees that practically everything government, especially central government, especially federal government, in the case of the United States, practically everything that it touches is morally corrupted, inadequate, ineffective, enormously expensive to compared to what it could be elsewhere. And so a variety of us come out and we'd say, you know, maybe there could be a private free market provisioning of groceries, grocers, purveyors of exotic foods, purveyors of common foods, purveyors of very nice meat, whether it would be of the prime variety or choice variety or dairy or anything like that. All of a sudden, you and I could also say, we could call it Publix, we could call it Safeway, we could call it Winn-Dixie, we could call it Piggly Wiggly, we could call it Costco. Well, what would happen is people would come out of the woodwork and they would say, despite the fact that there is so much waste, despite the fact that there are so many government warehouses in which food rots because the bureaucracies have become so large and unwieldy with the government grocery unions and such, but what would happen if we privatized this and all of a sudden people would starve? People wouldn't be able to feed themselves. Of recent history, we just went through an alleged government shutdown. I say alleged because we all know the government didn't really shut down. It was a lot of political theater. But nonetheless, it comes to the fore that there are 40 million recipients of SNAP, which is the Supplemental Nutrition Program that the Department of Agriculture at the federal level administers for people so that they don't starve, so that they don't go hungry. Well, look, so we all know that the government would do a terrible job at grocer, food, meat, dairy, and vegetable or fruit provisioning in exponentially worse fashion than anything the private market could deliver. We all know that. Having home educated my children, I know that if I had $25,000 per pupil in my house, and we did not have that as far as the provisioning of libraries, cooperatives, teaching, training, lab equipment, stuff like that, we didn't have that, but we got by and we did the right thing. But the other thing is, my children learned to learn. They weren't simply taught, because the learning to learn, the learning to think critically, the learning to think for yourself, and the learning to have the moral courage to even say out loud to those who disagree with you that not only do I disagree with you, but why don't you provide evidence for your position instead of resorting to ad hominem argumentation? Well, we all know that that's not what happens in the government schools. And that for maybe, let's say, up to 2/3 of the waking hours of children, ages 5 and 6 till early adulthood at 17, 18, and 19, are spent in these government schools.
And we're seeing what comes out the other end, and it isn't pretty. Then we see in the colleges that what comes out the other end is not pretty. Even in the STEM environments, we're seeing some of the bleed off from the absolute nonsense that informs so much of the academy. There are literally tens of thousands of academic journals out there now. We're sort of revving forward to the collegiate and university enterprise in that ecology. And they publish these articles that have reproducibility problems. They have problems trying to look at the conclusions or in the results and reproducing them in a fashion that everyone can agree and say, yay and verily, yes, that's reproducible. That's not the case. There's this site called Retraction Watch that examines when journals, and this is a single-digit percentage of journals, when these journals publish retractions where they say, well, that didn't quite play out now, did it? When Miss Gay, the head, the woke head, the woke affirmative action head of Harvard had to resign because of plagiarism, she plagiarized her acknowledgments. I repeat, she even plagiarized her acknowledgments. That is the tip of the iceberg. If Mr. Musk could muster the funds to develop a very sophisticated AI scraping mechanism that could go through these tens of thousands of electronic academic journals and test them for findings, reproducibility, what retractions have occurred, footnoting, data provenance, accuracy, and precision, to see if the claims made are actually substantiated claims that others can poke at and find that they stand up to intense cross-examination and scrutiny. The revelations from that project would shatter at an exponentially earthquake Richter scale level confidence of the entire West, much less just America, in the university system, because we would discover that the emperor has no clothes. In that article, Why Schools Don't Educate, by John Taylor Gatto, he does a very interesting thing. He says, quote, but here is the calculus of time the children I teach must deal with. Out of the 168 hours in each week, my children sleep 56. That leaves them 112 hours a week out of which to fashion a self. My children watch 55 hours of television a week, according to recent reports. That leaves them 57 hours a week in which to grow up. My children attend school 30 hours a week, use about 6 hours getting ready, going and coming home, and spend an average of 7 hours a week on homework, a total of 45. During that time, they are under constant surveillance, have no private time or private space, and are disciplined if they try to assert individuality in the use of time and space. That leaves 12 hours a week out of which to create a unique consciousness. Of course, my kids eat, and that takes some time, not much, because they've lost the tradition of family dining. But if we allot 3 hours a week to evening meals, we arrive at a net amount of private time for each child of 9 hours. That is not enough. It's not enough, is it? The richer the kid, of course, the less television he watches. But the rich kid's time is just as narrowly prescribed by a somewhat broader catalog of commercial entertainments. End of quote. I highly recommend that you read this, because when you look at this, and mind you, we're just dealing with K through 12 here, you find that there are some tragic circumstances that are developing here. We go back to Gatto. Quote, I want to tell you what the effect is on children of taking all their time from them, time they need to grow up, and forcing them to spend it on abstractions. You need to hear this, because no reform that doesn't attack these specific pathologies will be anything more than a facade. Number one, the children I teach are indifferent to the adult world. This defies the experience of thousands of years. A close study of what big people were up to was always the most exciting occupation of youth, but nobody wants to grow up these days, and who can blame them? Toys R Us. Number two, the children I teach have almost no curiosity, and what they do have is transitory. They cannot concentrate for very long, even on things they choose to do. Can you see a connection between the bells ringing again and again to change classes and this phenomenon of evanescent attention? Number three, the children I teach have a poor sense of the future of how tomorrow is inextricably linked to today. As I said before, they have a continuous present. The exact moment they are at is the boundary of their consciousness. Number four, the children I teach are ahistorical. They have no sense of how past has predestined their own present, limiting their choices, shaping their values and lives. Number five, the children I teach are cruel to each other. They lack compassion for misfortune. They laugh at weakness, and they have contempt for people whose need for help shows too plainly. Number six, the children I teach are uneasy with intimacy or candor. My guess is that they are like many adopted people I've known in this respect. They cannot deal with genuine intimacy because of a lifelong habit of preserving a secret inner self inside a larger outer personality made up of artificial bits and pieces of behavior borrowed from television or acquired to manipulate teachers. Because they are not who they represent themselves to be, the disguise wears thin in the presence of intimacy, so intimate relationships have to be avoided. Number seven, the children I teach are materialistic, following the lead of school teachers who materialistically grade everything and television mentors who offer everything in the world for free. Number eight, finally, the children I teach are dependent, passive, and timid in the presence of new challenges. This is frequently masked by surface bravado or by anger or aggressiveness, but underneath is a vacuum without fortitude. End of quote. What I just read you was published in June 1990. What has happened since then that you think would aggravate the things that I just elucidated from the brilliant John Taylor Gatto? Cell phones, smartphones, screen attention, screen addiction. The ability to actually truncate views of the world into bite-sized pieces. It is rewiring the brain and has been rewiring the brain. Dad Saves America podcast, John P., goes into a lot of detail on this on other podcasts where he talks about the way children's brains are actually being rewired with an almost inability baked in to handle complex equations, handle complex questions, do the comprehensivist investigations forensically that I've talked about in the past, where one reads 3 to 5 books on one single subject as an active reader interrogating said subject, looking at footnotes, maybe even digging into said footnotes to achieve a better mastery of the subject matter. Whatever that may be, it could be anything from aircraft design to 3D printing to whatever your hobbyist historiography inquiries may be. Maybe you're a World War II European theater person who's interested in what happened then, and you read lots of books. Military history happens to be a subgenre of history. By the way, I will be devoting an entire episode to my investigation of why is it that military history tends to be extremely popular with folks as laymen who are reading, but is poo-pooed and dismissed in the academy, whether that's the Marxist Organization of American Historian or the Marxist American Historical Association. You will find time and again that military history, like the classics departments around the world, have not only been shuttered, but you would have a very hard time finding more than half a dozen postgraduate schools in America that are offering formal military history degrees as discrete entities in those degree-granting institutions. So we see a crisis here, where K through 12, you have automatons and drones who can barely speak their own names, going to college. College, whether STEM, science, technology, engineering, and maths, or non-STEM, everything else, are taught by a very narrow socioeconomic viewpoint. In this case, as my perennial listeners know, I'm fond of using the rubric of government supremacist to act as an umbrella of sorts to cover those who believe in communism, democratic socialism, fascism, and all of the collectivist versus individualist creeds that are out there on planet Earth and that have been refined in the last 250 years. Now, as most of you are aware, especially those of you who have actually gone to college, but you will find the same thing when you're in high school, is that many surveys have come out, and I think that they're very narrow-minded surveys because they only look at the popular notions of Republican and Democrat as the bifurcation lines of what is conservative and liberal or what is right of center and what is left of center. Those of you who are listeners of mine know how I feel about that late 18th century French descriptor of who falls where when it comes to the degree of government one tolerates in one's life. But more than 95%, one finds this in the media also, one could characterize them even charitably as left of center. It is through these left of center organic megaphones in the collegiate academies, the universities, where the sole worldview that's being communicated is not one that embraces individualism, that embraces free markets, that embraces sound money, and those kind of things. It is almost a constant, all waking hours megaphone in driving these students further and further to the left in the fashion in which they perceive, apprehend, and examine the world around them. I think that this is deadly. And one reason I think it's deadly is because if one were to, and this is anecdotal, and I would love to see if anybody has empirical evidence speaking to this, most folks who are members of anti-fascist organizations like Antifa and the rest of them, you will find that they've been to college. Now, they've either attended college or they're college graduates, but they certainly get the notion, despite 125 years teaching us otherwise, that communism is not only a possibility, but that communism is the only moral buttress to thinking and feeling human beings that they are wrong if that is not their goal, object, and socioeconomic ecology that they seek. Remember, not to put too fine a point on it, but one of the planks in the Communist Manifesto is the sole government provisioning of education as an important means by which one could inculcate the young into embracing this as the revolutionary imperative upon which they set their shoulders to the wheel to make it happen. There's an article by Jonathan Hunt called Communist and the Classroom, Radicals in U.S. Education, 1930 to 1960, which I find very interesting in this regard. Quote, the most prominent communist in education during this period was Granville Hicks, who was among the few members of the Communist Party to be relatively open about membership, and one of many intellectuals who joined the party during the Popular Front period in the middle and late 1930s, a time when, in the words of his Harvard colleague Daniel Aaron, a communist seemed hardly more exotic than a Republican or elk. The Harvard-educated Hicks first became widely known during the 1930s as an essayist and literary critic whose work appeared in such periodicals as The Nation, The New Republic, SAQ, American Literature, even H.L. Mencken's American Mercury and other magazines. As he moved to the left through the 1930s, Hicks became a contributor and subsequently literary editor of The New Masses. He was fired from the English department at RPI in 1935, most probably due to his radical political association and his published work, which included the great tradition and openly Marxist rereading of the U.S. literary canon. While openly a communist, he was employed at Harvard on a one-year contract, 38 to 39. Along with many others, he left the party in the fall of 1939 as a result of the Nazi-Soviet non-aggression pact of that year. That pact would be August and September of 1939 when the marriage of convenience between the National Socialists and the Soviet Communists allowed them to meet in the middle of Poland in September, and this pact would not be broached until Operation Barbarossa, where the Germans invaded the Soviet Union in June 1941. This would have a devastating impact on the Communist Party in the USA, as I talked about in parts 1 and 2 of this particular podcast series of episodes. What I'm really aiming at here is there are a variety of symptoms that have emerged that show that Antifa is indeed a communist insurgency, lowercase c, communist insurgency, and that the goals, whether it's the all cops are bastards ACAB slogans, the opposition to almost all federal policies of the GOP. Now, mind you, the Democratic Socialists of America have a beef with both the Democrats and the Republicans, both of those left wings of the uniparty in the United States. But nonetheless, when it comes to the intersectional cannibalism that one witnesses among those who differ with each other, whether they're Democratic Socialists of America or maybe Socialist Democrats of America, much like the Monty Python skit where you have the People's Front of Judea fighting in bloody rhetorical slashes in combat against the Judean People's Front. Much like one would look if you look at the brief historical snapshot of the Spanish Civil War between the alleged fascist nationalist and the communist. The communist splinter groups and the intersectional cannibalism that caused so many command and control problems, rifts, and political breaches made them rather inimical to success in that particular conflict because of this constant infighting. But nonetheless, there is not a unified vision of communism because it tends to, for a variety of reasons, calve itself off into various differing factions whose points of fidelity and granularity and allegiance to those microscopic points of granularity can either have you be a member of the A team or a member of the B team because you will be excommunicated for not taking a 100% attitude of allegiance to a certain set of values on the left. This kind of government supremacist infighting is almost inevitable. I think that to a certain extent, it is because when it comes to individualist, what is characterized as the right, they tend to be the ones who are live and let live. They tend to be much more tolerant of cross-examination. And they are also the ones who don't tend to apply litmus tests to its individual members or friendship organizations or whatever, in which you will be written out of said organization if you happen to disagree with one of 100 planks. It's I can't quite put my finger on why that's the case, but I do think the love of process and bureaucracy that one finds on the left that tends to become the bugbear, the binder, the glue that holds them together. Therefore, it is held as a totem and a sacrament to make sure that everything is observed and abided by. One can see this with the woke phenomenon that we have today, where all of a sudden the race, class, and gender of the last 50 years that has animated academia finds itself at a more refined and fine point with skin color and groin tackle, whether biological, assumed, or Frankenstein, to be the markers. These are external markers that determine the inner markers of character for who someone is. Ironically enough, if one goes back to the identitarian totalitarianism of the National Socialists when it came to the observance of Aryan purity and the verities of being an Aryan, that if one looked in the 21st century for the heirs, for those who are carrying on that tradition, not quite in the sartorial splendor of the Nazis, would be the woketopians, would be the woke folks, and what has been I consider a disease blot on the culture since the early 2010s, which became what it is today as a result of the acceptance of political correctness, lowercase, from the 1990s and the early 2000s, that morphed into the more institutionalized woke nonsense that we have all labored under today. I had mentioned earlier that there is a connection between K through 12 and then, of course, the collegiate enterprises that occur afterwards, where all of a sudden you find in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s that college degrees were much more desirable and almost pushed as a mandatory rite of passage for young people after the conclusion of their 13 years of pre-collegiate institutionalism. John Dewey was a significant part of the 20th century phenomenon of government education and ensuring that it happens. He was a major voice of progressive education and liberalism. And it was while a professor at the University of Chicago, he founded the University of Chicago Laboratory Schools, where he was able to apply and test his progressive ideas on pedagogical method. Pedagogical method would be the art of teaching, the art of learning, the art of acquiring knowledge, and the art of manipulating the world with said knowledge to make it into something that it wasn't before. So the point that I think I'd like to get across is that the 13 years spent in the government schools prior to college, and then potentially the remaining 4 years to get one's baccalaureate degree if you choose to stay on to get a PhD. The average time for getting said PhD is 8 to 10 years, so you're looking at, let's make the math easy here, 10 plus 4, even though most people take 5 years to complete a four-year degree. But we're going to call it 14 plus 13, which means that by the mid-20s, these students, these children, have spent most of their waking hours in institutions that are totally devoted to a singular mindset that is Borg-like in its worship of government supremacism. It's worship of not only the bureaucratization of society and ensuring that a mean or aggregate average of human beings is achieved, where they all assign and consign themselves to a belief system that always makes themselves a subsidiary to a greater power. There's a friend of mine who would often joke, he'd say, so if a single man isn't capable of governing himself, how on earth can a single man be capable of governing millions of others? I'll leave that to you to tease out for all of the implications with that. The point that I'm making here in this series and in this discussion conversation that we're having today is that communism, collectivism, what E.O. Wilson said, great idea, wrong species, since he thought that ants and other insects would make great communists, humans, not so much. This has been the shaping mechanism. So all these waking hours, anecdotally, those parents out there who have sent their children on to college, when your children come back for a holiday or they come back to visit or maybe they spend part of the summer with you, you sense a change in their attitude about the world. You sense a change not only in their critical thinking skills, not only in their questioning regimes, not only in their ability to not concede to authority, but the almost antithetical way in which they view the world That means that if only more people in government were in charge, the world would be such a different place. Now, when you interrogate same people and you ask them about the historical record of communism in the 20th century, for instance, you get a number of reposts to include, well, that's not real communism. If that's the case, why is it that the universally accepted bad guys in recent history in the last 100 years is the NSDAP, the National Socialists, the Nazis? Could one have a retort where they say, well, that's what's wrong with National Socialism? Could one retort by saying, well, they didn't do it right? I don't think so. I don't think that's the case at all. But somehow, some way, National Socialism is incredibly bad, and I happen to agree with that, but communism, not so much. When you look at Hollywood productions since the 1930s, how many have you seen have been overtly, if not in a sub rosa fashion, critical of the communist project wherever it is used? It is always given a pass, a wave, excuses, whereby when it comes to the Nazis and to Hitler, universally seen as villains and bad people and all the rest. I happen to agree with that, but I also think that one can still be looking at the swastika and looking at the hammer and sickle and saying those are both deadly, violent, and disgusting political creeds. But that is not polite conversation in the American Academy. One can't possibly say that for a variety of reasons. Now, there are many others out there who have taken on this problem set of why are the Nazis bad guys but the communists aren't. I'm not going to bore you with that because I think there's other people who have covered this ground, to include my former mentor and leader of my internship at the Hoover Institution, Robert Conquest, to include books like The Black Book of Communism, which I recommend everybody read if you get the opportunity. George Orwell has covered this, and Rand has covered this. All of them make the point, as H.L. Mencken has said, that when it comes to government supremacism and using that as an umbrella rubric to describe both National Socialism and communism underneath it, they are both anti-human. I'll probably lose some listeners because of the next minute, but there it is. I recommend Martyrmaid, who I admire so much of Darryl Cooper's work. He did a podcast episode, number 19, called The Anti-Humans. I highly recommend that you listen to this. Now, mind you, I have this proviso. You cannot listen to this and come out of the other side, if you've been paying attention, and not find your soul darker and not find your morals a bit corrupted, even though you took no part in what happened in that. To quote Darryl Cooper in his introduction, after Nazi Germany was defeated in the Second World War, Stalin's Soviet Union unleashed hell on the devastated nations of Eastern Europe, leaving behind an unmatched record of sadism and brutality. What he discusses is what happened in Romania's Petesti Penitentiary between 1949 and 1951. I'll be sure to leave a link to said podcast in the show notes. There is an article, I'll leave a link to this also, by Arlene Jonescu from Shanghai Jiao Tong University, believe it or not, entitled Witnessing Horrorism, the Petesti Experiment. It reads, quote, this article will explore a highly traumatic experiment that was conducted during a totalitarian regime in Romania on more than 780 students who, because of real or imaginary activities against the communist regime, were incarcerated and re-educated in the Petesti Penitentiary between 1949 and 1951, end of quote. This was an infamous example of trying to create Homo Sovieticus, and it is yet another artifact in this vast library, this vast sepulcher of what communism has done to planet Earth since it started in the 19th century. By the way, why do I say it started in the 19th century? Because Karl Marx arrived on the scene just as chattel slavery was starting to get a shine taken off of it, where so many, thanks to England starting the whole process, so many were finding it unspeakable and immoral to own other human beings. And Karl Marx arrives just in time to save chattel slavery by sort of revamping it in an advertisement campaign that would show folks who were interested in government institutions and those outside who wanted to create said government institutions that we're going to put a new name, we're going to remarket, we're going to use a new ad campaign for chattel slavery that is so vital and effervescent that people are going to beg for it. In this case, it would be communism, because communism is certainly a form of slavery. In this article, she examines several works that were done on this by Dominic LaCapra, Lawrence Langer, Kathy Carruth, Shoshana Fellman, and Dori Laub on the process of witnessing and testifying. And they showed that after the horrible experiences, the victims' recollections of the event can be obliterated. She says in here, quote, "The last section of the article focused on the actions and effects of Turcano and his team. They engineered the annihilation of man through psychological terror and reduced human beings to Pavlovian dogs. This was the indirect violence of the totalitarian regime installed in Romania after World War II, a violence that inflicted wounds impossible to heal," end of quote. This kind of inhuman sadism and this kind of parade of horrors and this yen, this almost implacable will to recreate human beings in a new mold, this Homo Sovieticus, it informs so much of what you see casually spoken to in Antifa literature and communist literature, East and West, this constant refrain to remake man in a, quote, better, unquote, image. This is not what happens. These are horror factories. And the fact that we have an entire generation or two or three that is absolutely enamored by this sadistic and cruel creed is not only a condemnation of their critical thinking and cross-examination skills and the people they would choose to be around who would reinforce said things, but the very fact that a society, a civilization, a government would spend hundreds of millions, if not tens of billions of dollars on an educational process that almost without exception endorses this phenomenon astonishes me. So if I may leave you with this cautionary note, yea and verily, I think that the Orchid House for communism in America and the West is the education system. The finishing school is the university system. And worst of all, it has been incentivized, subsidized, and eventually it will be terrorized by the adoption of this creed throughout our entire society. At the atomistic level, at the microcosmic level, you may very well lose your child if you send them to a four-year university. Folks have reached out to me and they've said, I have children, I have grandchildren, and their future is so bright, they have sunglasses, what should they do? And I always say, please do not pursue a non-STEM degree in a four-year university. Community colleges can be just as bad, but if you're looking for a way to raise a family, make a good living, have moral satisfaction, and just be a good part of society and be a good person to yourself and those around you, get a trade. I think that's a far better idea. So thanks for listening. And yes, I am getting to a point in these episodes where I will lay out a map of what we can do from several perspectives to either arrest or stop this growing communist threat to America and the West. So thanks for listening. I encourage my listeners to write me at cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. Please visit my Substack. When I publish my episodes there, I have a comment function. I would love to hear from my listeners. Well, I want to hear from you in several ways. Number one, if you like the podcast, great. And I want to hear what you think of it. If you have any questions, are there things that I left out? Maybe even constructive criticism, like my lack of proper pronunciation, which I tried to correct at the beginning of this very episode. But I would love to hear from more of you. I've gone over 2,000 subscribers at my Substack. I have approximately 48 paid subscribers. You will note that I never have my hat in hand. I'm never asking my listeners for money, but 48 of you stepped up, and I thank you from the bottom of my heart for contributing to, like, purchasing books for research and the equipment that I need to do this podcast. You are studs, and I really appreciate the fact that you have reached out. As my paid subscribers know, you will get my another email variant from me that lets you get in touch with me rather quickly if you wish. And we have great conversations as a result of that. I can't believe we're here, but I think that combined with War Notes, my companion podcast, where I cover conventional warfare, I am probably maybe 5 episodes from 100 episodes of this. When I started this project over 3 years ago, I had no idea where it would go, where it would land, and how long it would last. And here we are 3 years later. So I think that puts me I'm in the top 10% of podcasts per my episodes produced and the number of downloads that we get. And remember, that also means that there are 4.5 million podcasts worldwide. So thanks to everybody for listening. So if you have friends, family, colleagues, or people at work who may be interested and what I have to say, and I know it can be rather esoteric and arcane at times, I would appreciate you passing the word and turning them onto it. And if you're so kind as to leave a starred review, or better yet, a narrative review at the podcast vendor of your choice, I will be forever grateful. So, this is Bill, out.